How would you like to scale a USA property portfolio remotely and safely? David Garner, he's a property investor and he will tell us exactly how to do this. So, David, tell us more about how can entrepreneurs scale a USA property portfolio remotely?
Property Wealth Strategies podcast with Lily Patrashko shares world's most influential property investors, sharing their strategies for making money with property.
Something I've got a little bit of experience in. I started buying US real estate back in 2016. And we actually kind of fell into the space by accident. We loaned some money to a real estate investor in the US who was rehabbing houses. So he was buying cheap houses, adding value, and then keeping them and renting them and flipping them. But unfortunately, that deal didn't quite work out for us. That guy didn't do what he said he was going to do. And we ended up foreclosing on the loan that we extended to him. So we found ourselves in the interesting situation of owning 34 houses in the deep south in Mississippi. They were in South Jackson, Mississippi, which, if anyone knows the US, is kind of a rough neighborhood. And we sat down and we were kind of scratching our heads, figuring out, what do we do? Do we sell these and take a bit of a bath? Or do we try and complete the job that was not done in the first place? And we decided the second option was going to potentially see us take a lesser loss. And as it turned out, we figured out that we were quite good at that. So we started to, we decided to keep hold of the portfolio after we'd renovated them. And we started to scale. So we started to buy more properties, which involved, there's a lot behind that, sourcing the funding to do that, sourcing the properties and building a team remotely. And that's really been our biggest challenge, is building a team. But since then, we've bought over 120 properties in the US between my wife and I. We sold a bunch of those off. So we have about 64 houses in our portfolio right now. And yeah, it's been somewhat of a journey, but we kind of fell into it by accident.
Thank you. So for someone considering creating a property portfolio and not knowing the rules and the regulations in the USA, what are the types of things they need to put in place first so that they can, you know, keep to the rules and make sure that everything runs smoothly?
That is an excellent question. So a big part of my day now is helping other non-residents invest in the US real estate market safely and remotely. And that's really a huge, huge part of it. I speak to people every day from Canada, from the UK, and from Australia and Latin America, where most of our clients are based, that have already gone out there and bought properties. And they now are falling foul of tax regulations. They've set up their investment structure by, you know, watching YouTube or seeing Instagram shorts of people making recommendations. So my advice is always start with the people. You know, we're a people first business. And the biggest lesson that I learned scaling my own portfolio in the US is that you'll sure have property problems, but the biggest problems that you'll have are people problems. Having the right people in the right function that can provide you with the right advice that's based on your specific circumstances is absolutely key, not only to doing it safely, but being able to scale as well. And like I said, I think most of the problems that we've had that we've not been able to resolve satisfactorily, and you know, the disasters that we've had along the way, which everybody does, have really been down to us having the wrong people in place. So my advice is always start building your team, start networking, start connecting with other investors and other service providers in the real estate space that can advise you how to set up your investment structure, how to navigate US banking, which can be quite difficult if you're not there in the US to open an account, how to source the financing, the specialist financing that's available for non-residents, and making sure that you're buying the right property in the right market so you have a good local team that can advise you on the local market dynamics.
Thank you. So for example, for financing, I mean, because I've had a few guests that talked about financing, and what I found quite shocking is that, for example, when you live in the UK, you still can manage to get a mortgage, for example, for a property in the US, if you put down, for example, 25% and of the deposit, just on the merit of the property itself. It doesn't have to even mean that you have to show like your wages and your whatever you make in your business and this kind of thing. And I thought that was very interesting. Are there any other investment schemes or any other like financing opportunities that are available for people that are living abroad that perhaps most investors aren't aware of?
Yeah, so that's, again, a really good question. So what you're describing there is a DSCR loan. It's a debt service coverage ratio loan. That's what I use to either buy or refinance all of the properties that I own in the US. We have about $3.2 million worth of debt secured against our portfolio right now, which is 64 loans. Most of them have been refinanced multiple times. But a DSCR loan essentially is where the lender will underwrite the property. So that's the kind of loan that we use to help all of our clients buy their rental properties in the US. And the lender's looking to see if the gross rental income will cover the total mortgage payment, which is the principal and interest, taxes, insurance, and if there is one, a HOA, a homeowners association fee, because those are the fixed costs of ownership. And what the lender is generally looking for is for the gross rent to be about 125% of that total mortgage payment. And those loans can be really, really useful for non-residents because, as you said, there's no personal income verification. There are no credit checks. You don't need a US social security number. And all of those challenges and hurdles that can make it really difficult to get a mortgage, no matter where you're based, right? Debt to income ratios and your personal income, how many loans you have, they can all factor in for a lender when they're underwriting a loan. With DSCR loans, in fact, we got confirmation of an approval for one today. It's a Canadian client. They're buying a rental property in Kansas City, of all places. No income, no personal income. The guy's self-employed, no US credit, and the loan got approved within 24 hours. So that's really the kind of the main source of funding that we'd use. If you're going to go out there and you're going to buy something that's the US equivalent of a buy-to-let property, I would always recommend looking at various types of DSCR loan that are available. But to answer your question about different types of funding, we built our portfolio using private money. And private money is a non-bank loan, and it can be from a professional private money lender, a hard money lender, or it can be from just a person. And that person, that's what we did. We created an investment program that allowed mom and pop investors, as you would call them in the United States, to loan us money, which was secured against the property. And that has allowed us to go out and find really good deals because we had cash on the hip and we could close really quickly. And those were short-term loans. So it's a bit like bridging finance. It's purely for acquisitions and renovations. So we would use that money to acquire and renovate the property. And then we would refinance with a DSCR loan within 3 to 6 months for our long-term hold strategy. So private and hard money can be a really, really useful tool if you're looking for value add properties. But again, if we're overseas, one thing I can tell you is it's pretty difficult to manage contractors and renovation projects when you're not physically there, never mind, you know, 5,000-6,000 miles away. That can be really, really challenging. So you have to be a little bit careful. You know, the grass looks really, really green there because, you know, those deals look like they're going to be really profitable, but when you start getting into the weeds and you start dealing with contractors and construction problems, that can be really difficult to manage.
Thank you. Are there any other financing opportunities that perhaps are not so common, are not so widely known to broad investors that you want to mention before we move on to the next thing?
Yeah, I think really private money, as I said, is it's been the cornerstone of allowing us to scale the property portfolio that we have as quickly as we did. Now, that's not necessary for everybody. They're high risk loans, tend to be interest only loans, but it's very much, I see this kind of developing in the UK right now over the last few years. People are using private investors to fund their UK property deals. And we've been doing that in the States for, I've been doing it in the States for 10 years. I have a mentor that's been doing that for 50 years. And, you know, I'm starting also to see in the UK people wholesaling properties, which has been very common in the US for a long, long time. But in terms of the financing, if you're buying something value add, you can consider private money or hard money. If you're looking at a long-term hold, generally a DSCR loan will be your best financing option. There are two other financing options as well. That's a full documentation loan, and that's underwritten just like a conventional mortgage. But the lender in the US will use your, if you're from the UK, your UK credit, your UK income, and your UK assets to underwrite the loan. So you get a better interest rate because they're borrower centric. And the other financing option is an ITIN loan. And that's if you already do business in the States, you already have US source income, you'll have an ITIN number, which is your tax identification number. And that means you'll be already paying US taxes. So they'll be able to use your US income to underwrite the loan. But if you're just a foreigner like me, then a DSCR loan or private money are going to be your best funding options.
Thank you. For those UK investors looking to move to the US, will they get a really good deal for investing in the US in the sense of like, are there any specific really good deals just for people who move to the US, for example?
Short answer is no. So the US is probably one of the most popular global markets for real estate investors because property rights are the same for foreigners as they are for the US citizens. So there's no real difference in ownership rights. Places, you know, you see people buying properties in places like Thailand because it's more of a lifestyle choice and there are ownership restrictions. There's nothing like that in the States. There are some state level restrictions on buying things like agricultural land. If you're from certain countries, China, for example, in Florida, you're not allowed to buy a lot of agricultural land and you're not allowed to buy near a military installation. Those are state level restrictions. But the key answer to your question is no. A lot of people come to us because they want a green card or a visa. You can use real estate to get a particular type of visa, but you have to make a really, really big investment and it has to fit some very, very specific criteria. So if you want to go move to the States, real estate, it's not going to help you other than having a roof over your head. It's not going to give you any advantage over anybody else.
Thank you. Are there any advantages of investing in the US versus investing in the UK or other markets that you're more familiar with? And if so, what are those advantages?
Really good question. So in the past, I would say 6 months, I've had more conversations with UK landlords than I have in the past 5 years. And I think really people are looking outside of the UK specifically for all the reasons we know about. You know, you switch on the news and landlords are getting hammered with taxes and regulations and the renters reform bill. And all of those things are going into the mix. I spoke to a chap, a really successful long-time UK property investor who owns a big portfolio in Victoria, London. He owns a small hotel in Victoria as well. And he's selling off everything. He doesn't believe that his model is viable anymore with the current economic and political climate that you have in the UK. So it's an interesting question because I would say my Canadian clients are looking at the US because it's close. Very difficult to find a good cash flowing deal in Canada because prices are high and rents are low. So they look to the US because it's close. We speak the same language, very similar legal systems. When I'm dealing with a UK client or someone like myself, the US offers better cash flow, cheaper prices, easier access to financing, no limit on the amount of loans that you can have. And again, it's the same language and a very similar legal system. So I think familiarity is one of the biggest drivers for UK investors. But then I'm based in Argentina. I moved out here in 2022. And we do a lot of business with Latin Americans from Colombia, from Argentina, from Chile, that are looking to buy in the US. And they have a very different reason for investing. The economies in this region tend to be a lot less stable. And the currencies certainly are a lot less stable. You know, I'm living in Argentina, the Argentinian peso has decreased in value. Inflation has been 300% since I've been here. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. So those guys are looking to use the money that they do have to acquire dollar-based assets. That's the most important thing for those guys. They're looking for an asset that's going to remain in dollars and it's going to produce dollar-based income. And you're going to get secure property rights because you speak to your average Argentinian, they're worried about the peso, they're worried about the economy, they're worried about property rights. They have a history in this country of taking property and money away from citizens. That's in the not too distant past. So they look to the US because it's safe and it's secure and it's dollar based. But everybody has a different reason. So it's an interesting question because if I speak to someone from the UK or someone from Colombia, they'll have very different reasons for investing in the US.
Thank you. What's the best way to find a really great property manager in the US that can manage the property for you hassle-free? And considering, especially because I have been shocked that housing association costs can be really high, okay? Mm. So much so that they can eat into a lot of your profit. For some of these properties, and other properties are a lot lower in terms of like the housing association costs. So I'm wondering what do you suggest for people to do to find like a really good manager that will be able to like take care of their property without too much hassle? I mean, there's always going to be that thing in your mind that, oh, my property's there and, you know, you're far away.
It was a big thing for us as we started to scale this portfolio. It became pretty overwhelming at one point because you get to kind of double. We went into it with double figures because we bought 30 odd properties, but or took ownership of 30 odd properties. But when you start to scale that, it can get quite overwhelming because it's not passive income; it's property, right? Anybody marketing a property as passive is either naive or misinformed. So, property management. In my experience over the last 10 years, a good property manager can kill a good deal and or a bad property manager can kill a good deal and a good property manager can save a kind of average deal. Really, really difficult to find a good quality property manager in the US. And I think based on the experiences that I've had, and I've been through a lot of property managers, is there's a sweet spot. You don't want a really big property manager with big offices and big systems and processes in place because they tend to make their margin. It's not a very profitable business, property management. They're charging 10% of your rents and they've got staff and offices and all that kind of stuff to pay. So they tend to make their money from markups on repair costs and lease up fees, which is where you're turning over the property and you're putting a new tenant in there. And that is in sort of direct conflict with our goals as a landlord. We want our tenant to stay in the property as long as possible, right? We don't want turnovers. They will kill a rental property business. And that's something, we've learned along the way. So we want a property manager that's really incentivized to keep that tenant in the property. And that means looking after them. But unfortunately, when you get to a certain size, I think as a property manager, you lose that personal touch with your tenant. So for us, what we've found has really worked well is what we call in America the mom and pop operators, where it will be, a couple or a small family business. They'll have their own property portfolio in the neighborhoods that you're buying in, and it'll be in-house contracting. So it'll usually be the guy that goes out and fixes the toilets and does the plumbing repairs, but they're not hiring out those. They're not outsourcing. So they're not calling an emergency plumber for a $250 call out fee and then a $250 fix with a $250 margin on top. He's going out and for $100, he's fixing it and he's doing a good quality job because this is an integral part of their business. So for me, I found really, unfortunately, it's been a case of trial and error over the last 10 years, working with different property managers and kind of getting a feel for how they manage the tenant relationships and what their costs and fees are like when it comes to doing things like repairs, how responsive they are, and all of those things go into the mix when you're thinking, am I going to keep this tenant for 3 years or are they just going to get fed up and leave after a year because our property manager's not providing that level of service? So for me, and not everyone agrees with me, but for me, I found those smaller family businesses generally tend to operate much more efficiently and have a better sort of goal alignment with us as landlords than the big corporate sort of seemingly lower cost property managers who turn out to be much, much more expensive and end up costing you tenants. So yeah, the thing is, again, going back to one of the first things I said, it's building your team, right? It's working with the people that are going to have a certain amount of alignment with your goals and can provide the level of service that you need for a reasonable cost. And unfortunately, a lot of that's going to be trial and error and testing out relationships and seeing whether they work as described.
Thank you. I found as well, and I was a little bit shocked, but for example, it seems to me that handymen, cleaners, anyone that does roofing or any sort of like work that is like manual work around the house tends to be, at least appears to me, to be a lot more expensive than in London, in the UK. And you can contradict me with maybe some really great relationships that you've managed to build over time with the mom and pop kind of like property management companies. But from the prices that I've been hearing around like Miami and those kind of areas, it just sounds like such a ridiculous price that, I'm wondering, like, how does someone even make property portfolio profitable, considering all those like skyrocketing prices, like something breaks in your house, the roof breaks, or, you know, different things that break in your house. It's not like, you know, a trifle to like, you know, just pay someone and it will be like a quick, fast fix and that it would cost next to nothing. It appears
really good question.
The prices are a lot more expensive.
Yeah, it is. It can be, and that can really provide a bottleneck. That was a problem for us when we were renovating a lot of houses in one go. And we bid off more than we can chew, in honesty. At one point, we had a lot of renovation projects going on at the same time. And the bottleneck that we found was quality of workmanship. So the more contractors we needed, the lower the quality got. And in neighborhoods in the US, you'll find there's maybe one or two good contractors, and they're busy. Right, they've got work. They don't necessarily. It's difficult to get them. So then you either pay more or you get a lower level of quality. You know, it's time, quality, and money. Right, that trifecta. You can only have two. What a good example of that. I'll give you two examples of that. When we were renovating a bunch of houses in Pennsylvania, it was just coming out of COVID, and there was a lot of government support, welfare at city, state, and federal level. Because people weren't able to work. I think we can all agree if people aren't allowed to work, then we should, you know, subsidize them if they don't have savings. But what happened in the United States was a kind of weird situation because those funding mechanisms remained in place when COVID finished. So what I found is that if, for example, we wanted to do a trash out, if we were buying a house that we bought a lot of hoarder houses. So if we were buying one of those kind of houses, we would have a guy go around and clear the whole house out. We would pay for the skips, for the trash collection, and we couldn't get anyone to do it. And the reason we couldn't get anyone to do it at that moment in time was because they wanted, you know, $2,000 to go clean a house out. Because if they were to go and do the work, we're not prepared to pay cash in hand. We have to do everything through the books, right, in the US. So we can't say to someone, you know, we'll do it as a foreigner, if you like, as my dad would have said in the UK. We'll, you know, we're going to have to put it through the books, and we're going to have to get, you're going to have to invoice us. And they couldn't, because it would have stopped their welfare. So for the sake of one job, they just couldn't work. They was kind of stuck in that welfare trap. And that we're seeing a lot in the US. But again, it comes down to relationships. The other example is, we are replacing the HVAC, the sort of air conditioning system and heating system in one of our houses. And we got a quote from a big national company, and they wanted $12,000 to replace the HVAC. And then we got this, we found a guy for a recommendation from a contractor. He's a semi-retired guy, he's been doing HVAC all his life. He quoted us to supply and fit the exact same system for $6,000, right? So a lot of it is shopping around. And again, it all goes back to building those relationships and leveraging your network to find the right service providers that can do those jobs. Now, one of the property managers we have is the wife of one of our contractors in a certain neighborhood, you know, and it's something she does kind of on the side, but she's amazing with tenants. And we've never had a tenant leave, in fact, ever in those neighborhoods. All the houses we bought with tenants in still have those same tenants in. So again, same thing with handymen, absolutely the same. You can go get a quote from a licensed and insured who will invoice you contracting company, and they're not going to get out of bed for less than $500 because they have all of the costs associated with running their business. But we'll go speak to Joe Bloggs, who's been a handyman all of his life. He still has the requisite insurance in place, which is really important, and he'll still invoice us, but he'll go do that job for $250. So again, it's about building that network, and it's really neighborhood specific. In the States, you know, we do stuff in Kansas City, we do stuff in Cleveland, in Toledo, in Baltimore, and we have different providers in all different neighborhoods, because the guy that looks after two or three streets for us maybe can't get to, you know, two neighborhoods away, because it's just out of his remit. So you're absolutely right. If you go with a big national property manager who's outsourcing all of their repair work to, let's say, a cleaning company, they're going to be paying the cleaning company, is going to be paying the staff, and every single person in that layer cake is making a margin, and you're the one paying it. And that means you could be charged $600-$700 just to do a light clean, which is crazy, right? So it's really about, again, it's about finding those relationships. Nope.
Thank you. Have you found that currently there is any shortage of workers and handymen and the kind of providers you might need to actually run your USA property portfolio? Or would you say no, there is actually not a problem at the moment for someone who is, say, looking to start investing in the US right now?
There is a shortage for sure. Yeah. You know, the people that we work with, if I were that I have established relationships with, for things like, let's say, your average handyman in a particular neighborhood that I've been working with for maybe 3 or 4 years, if I went to him now as a new customer, he wouldn't be able to service me because he's full, right? He's one guy. So, you know, we've spent 10 years building our contact book, which is, I think, one of the value advantages, if you like, of working with someone like us, who's not necessarily a real estate agent, but an active investor. You get to leverage our network of contacts. So everybody that we help purchase property, we only sell properties in the neighborhoods we own properties in. So people get to hook into our network. So it's not so much of a problem, but I do see it all the time. We spoke to a Canadian guy from Quebec a couple of weeks ago. He'd been and bought a couple of houses in Cleveland. The contractor didn't do such a great job, and now he's really struggling to find somebody to remediate the work and get the properties occupied. So he's burning hard money interest. The properties are vacant. He's got work that still needs doing. Pretty soon he's going to get citations from the city code department as well. So he's kind of got himself into a bit of a pickle because he's gone property first rather than people first. But yeah, the answer to the question, yeah, there is a shortage, not necessarily a shortage of bodies, but certainly a shortage of quality and experience.
Thank you. How do you correctly safeguard your property portfolio from all the potential risks that could possibly go wrong because you are so far away from it? You are not able to like go there and open the door to anyone. You're not able to do anything in case there is a fire or any issue that may arise. What are the kinds of things the property investors could put in place to make sure the property is safe from all the different potential risks that could arise?
I guess that's probably the most important question, right? And the answer really starts with where you buy. One of the biggest problems that I see, a big part of my job is arguing with people about what not to buy, because people will come to us and say, I found this cheap $80,000 house and it's going to rent for $1,500 a month. And the truth is, the reason we don't own 120 properties right now, even though we bought that many, is because we bought the wrong kind of properties in the wrong neighborhoods because we thought they looked great on paper, and they're not. Those properties will never work out how you hope. They're in rough neighborhoods. You're going to have tenants with inherent social and financial problems, which is going to be a problem for you as a landlord. It's going to mean higher property management costs, higher turnovers, vacancies, evictions, more fees. And these properties tend to have been owned by local landlords for many, many years, which means, you know, they're held together with prayer and duct tape. And so underneath the sort of fresh new LVP flooring and the fresh paint, there's generally deep-seated problems. So item number one on the list is buy in a better neighborhood, spend more money. I would rather have one more expensive property in a B-class neighborhood than I would five properties in a D-class neighborhood because they're just a nightmare to manage. So the best thing you can do to protect yourself is buy in the right neighborhood. And then when you move on from there, the second thing is get a good property manager, right? Get somebody who's keeping a real good close eye on the property and understands tenant management, relationship management. So once you've got those two things in place, you're going to have to give careful consideration to how you structure the investment as well. The US is a very litigious place, right? It's probably the most litigious country on the planet. I've been sued 3 times in the last 10 years. The most comical of those was I had a tenant who had one of these big cane corso dogs. I have 7 dogs, so you know I love dogs, but this thing looked like something out of a movie, right? And she wasn't supposed to have it. We had a no pets lease in this case, where it wasn't a no pets lease, but she signed to say she didn't have a pet. This dog ran out of the house onto the street and bit a member of the public. And the county that that property was based in places legal responsibility on the owner of the property. So I get a lawsuit served with papers saying this person's suing you because somebody rented a property from you and their dog ran out on the street and bit you. So number one, you need to set up an investment structure that protects your personal liability, because if you lose a lawsuit in the United States, all of your global assets are at risk. If you get a judgment against you, someone could come after your pension, your cash, your stocks and shares, whatever else he's got, the books on the bookshelf behind you are theirs until that judgment is satisfied. So by wrapping the property in a corporate structure in the US, which could be an LLC, could be an LP, it could be a trust, it could be a corporation, that will limit your liability to the contents of that corporate entity. Figuring out the right corporate entity is not as straightforward as one might imagine. For example, a US LLC, if you're a Canadian, will cause a double taxation issue. So they need an LP and an LLC to manage the LP in order for it to be truly passed through and not end up with double taxation. But it will provide the liability protection you need and then buy liability insurance. It's not a huge cost. And if you do get sued, your insurer will handle it. And that was a big mistake that we made. We ended up paying a ton in legal fees because we didn't have the right insurance policy in place. Which is a real problem, right? So buy in the right neighborhood, get a good property manager, make sure your investment structure is right. And when I say right, I mean it's right for you, for your tax domicile, for the tax treaty that lies between the US and wherever you live, and your own personal tax planning goals. Different strokes for different folks, right? Most people just think, go set up a US LLC, not necessarily the right thing to do for a lot of people. So give some real serious consideration to the type of structure that you use to go out and buy a US property as well. So yeah, I would say that. Don't buy in the hood, get a good property manager and make sure that you set up your investment so that you don't expose your personal liability later on down the line.
Thank you. Considering all of these different like legality issues and so on, is it worth it to kind of like take the trouble to invest in the US versus, for example, investing in the UK or other countries? And if so, what was the biggest, you can say, deciding factor that made you think, wow, actually, I really need to go to the US, despite the fact that there's all of these different things that I need to learn, all of these different new consultants that I have to consult, and all of these like men that I have to chase and hunt down and make new relationships with?
Well, the truth is we didn't know all of this when we started. We've kind of had to figure it out as we go along. And we've been very, very lucky in some respects that we haven't fallen foul of some of the things we advise people not to do now based on our experience. But whether it's better or not, I don't know. That's going to depend on your worldview and your personal goals and objectives. Certainly from a pure financial perspective, second tier markets around the suburbs of second tier cities in the US cash flow way better than anything you'll find in the UK. And provided you do those things up front, you set up your investment structure right and you get liability insurance in place, which takes 24 hours. You know, it's not a huge ask. Then you've protected yourself from all of those things that can happen later on down the line. Whether it's better or not, I don't know. I think probably the theme of the conversation that I'm having with UK landlords right now, a big part of it is the Renters Reform Bill. Or is it the Renters Rights Act or Reform Bill? I'm not sure what it's called. But, you know, there's a lot of changes coming in, right? And when I tell people that I can evict a tenant for non-payment of rent and I can start that process within 5 days of them not paying rent, that it's kind of shocking, right? We've unfortunately had to evict for non-payment of rent and for property damage, you know, over the years from time to time. And the process is super easy and super quick in the States. So it's very landlord centric, the laws out there. And I think that's a really, really big appeal, certainly for people from the UK right now. You know, it's much, much more tax efficient in the US. You get a lot of deductions from your taxable income before you pay any taxes in the US when it's real estate income. So, you know, it's horses for courses. It's a long way away. It's not for everybody, but certainly when you weigh kind of the two up side by side, there are pluses and advantages for both. But like I say, for us, it wasn't really a decision. We loaned some money to somebody and they defaulted. So we ended up owning the properties they were secured against. So we kind of had a baptism of fire in that respect. And we stuck with it and we rolled with it. But I wouldn't say one was better than the other. It's going to depend on your own worldview and really what you want to achieve over the next 10 years, right?
Thank you. How long does it take from the moment, let's say a person hasn't paid, how long does it take for you to actually be able to evict? You said to initiate the process, it takes 5 days, but to actually evict them, how long does it take typically?
So that's going to vary based on the county. Well, certainly it's going to vary based on the state that you're in. Some states are not landlord friendly. So California, for example, really bad place to own a rental property. Cleveland, a great place to own a rental property as a landlord. It's very landlord-centric, and I can give you a real-life example of that. There's a process that you follow. After 5 days, you can post a 10-day pay or quit notice, and that is effectively a notice you post to the door or through your property management software, or you can even text or email it, as long as you have a record of it, to say you have 10 days to pay or quit the property. If they don't pay in that 10 days, you can file the eviction hearing. You'll usually get a hearing in the court within 30 days. If the tenant doesn't show up, they'll rule in your favor and you'll get the eviction. So they'll be out 30 days after that. So you're talking the short term, 30 to 60 days, you can have somebody out. It can take longer than that in some counties if there's a backlog in the local court system, or if the tenant knows how to game the system and they come with genuine reasons and they present them to the judge and say, look, we'll pay it, but this is our payment plan. You know, this is where we suggest we pay. Then the judge will more than likely say they can stay in the property, but they have to stick to the payment plan, and the court will enforce them if they don't stick to the payment plan. So it's not like you have to start the process again. If they say, look, we owe you $2,000 worth of rent, we'll pay you $500 a week for the next 4 weeks, and we agree to it, and they miss a payment, we can get the eviction straight away. So the court will continue to enforce that, which I think is a little bit different in different parts of the world. I think in the UK, if you make a plan with someone and they don't stick to it, you're probably going to have to start the process again, or at least go back to court. So it can be a much more lengthy process. But conversely, I have a client, an American client of mine, that owns rental properties in California, and it took him over a year to evict a tenant there. So it can really, really vary depending on where the property is based. So that should really go into your market selection and analysis process.
Thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
You can find us at our website, cashflowrentals.net. There's a ton of little buttons you can press on that site to book a call with me. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, all of the social media stuff. I'm not so great with social media, 45 years of age, and it tires me. But you can find me on there. It's usually Cashflow David or Cashflow David 2024. On most social media channels, but on the main point of contact is usually our website, where you'll also find a small selection of live inventory of properties as well. So that's cashflowrentals.net.
Follow me for more property wealth strategies.